Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author. Each week, Dr. Crosby interviews a fascinating new guest on a range of compelling topics, from literature to psychology to financial wellness. To learn more about Dr. Crosby's behavioral finance work at Orion, visit www.orion.com.
Hello and welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby, and today I'm joined by a very special guest, someone who has had a profound impact on the way that I think about markets, Meb Faber, co-founder and CIO of Cambria Investment Management and manager of the Cambria suite of ETF and SMA strategies. Meb is the author of a number of wonderful books, many of which he generously offers for free on his website, and he is the host of the Meb Faber Show podcast. Welcome to the show, sir.
Good to be here, my friend. Thanks for having me.
No, absolutely. So I want to start off, we'll start off with a softball. You grew up in Colorado and North Carolina, went to school in Virginia. You worked in DC and San Francisco. You've now settled in Southern California. Before the show, we were talking about a recent trip of yours to Puerto Rico. You travel a great deal and you've lived in all sort of corners of the country. And I'm curious how your travels have impacted the way you view the world of investing.
Well, I think travel for anyone impacts their views, not just about investing, but about everything, right? It informs kind of how you think about the world. And if you think about investing in particular, you know, so many people, we talk a lot about home country bias, you know, so many people have their small orbit in which they think about what's going on, you know, your friends, your neighbors, your state, your politics, your religion, whatever. And often that's confined to a pretty small place. And granted, the world's become a lot smaller with the internet and everything else going on with just geoeconomics, with the world being very interconnected. But the reality is we still tend to be very focused on the minutia of what's surrounding us. And what that leads us to often with the investing side style is to be invested only in what surrounds us because it feels warm and fuzzy. You know, you talk to people, the average American puts about 80% in the U.S. stock market of their stock allocation. And the U.S. is only about 60% of the globe and only about as far as stock weighting and only about a quarter of the total GDP. And so that's a big overweight. But the reality is every country does it. So it happens in Japan, happens to my friends in Australia, UK, on and on and on. And it's even worse in most countries because they're a much smaller percentage of the world market cap with stocks. And so you have this scenario where you realize, look, there's killer entrepreneurs all around the world. Some of the best and biggest companies or elsewhere in the world. And also, it becomes a huge mistake if you're an individual or an institution or an advisor investing in just one country. You can certainly look to recent examples like Russia, but also Greece. I mean, even the UK, which has gone back and forth with the US over the last 100 years for very similar equity market returns. UK has had a really tough run, their stock market for the past decade or so. But so you just get this sense that as you travel all around the world, in the investing sphere, it harkens back to the old Jim Rogers books, Investment Biker and Adventure Capitalist, where he drove around the world and looked about investing in all sorts of great countries. And in any given year, 75% of the best investments with stocks are outside the US, the best performing stocks. And so having this very narrow focus, no matter where you are, is usually a really bad idea. And that plays out through history. If you look at diversification, we have a post on our blog called The Case for Global Investing, and it basically demonstrates that if you diversify globally, you end up in a much better place as far as returns and volatility and drawdowns than you do if you concentrate in just one country. A lot of people want to extrapolate this U.S. exceptionalism in the stock market of the past 10 years forever, but in reality, that's pretty rare. The U.S. has creamed everything the past decade, but prior to that, it happened in the 90s, and prior to that, it didn't happen all the way back to the 1910s. So thinking globally when it comes to investing, but also just worldviews in general, gives you a great perspective that, you know, everyone doesn't think the same way you do, which is a good thing.
You know, the average American or more than half of Americans live within 6 miles of their hometown. And I'm in a position to make fun of that because I live like 100 miles from my hometown. But, you know, it's crazy how provincial we are in many ways. And when I spent a summer in Canada, and, you know, I was working with this sophisticated institution there who had a real interest in behavioral finance, which is why they brought me out. But even though the Canadian equity market is what, like 3 to 4% of the global equity market, their allocations to Canadian equities were still in the range of 35-40%, even knowing what they knew about home bias, because basically that was the smallest number they could get their investors to swallow. You know, home bias was so pervasive and such a thing that trying to align their allocation with, you know, to put it on par with the global equity markets would have been unpalatable for their investors. So that was sort of sinning a little in their minds.
The funny thing with all my Canadian friends too is it's not just that, it's even worse, because most of the Canadians I know, it's not like they're doing a really diversified Canadian exposure. They're dropping it in a handful of miners and cannabis stocks, maybe a bank or two. They end up with not only just one country, but a couple of very specific sectors as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Love you, Canada. So, Meb, in my mind, you're a bit of an outlier. You're a bit of an iconoclast in this industry. You're sort of a famously chilled out, soft-spoken guy. Surfer type vibes in an industry filled with type A chest pounders. So staying with this iconoclastic nature of yours, what is your least popular belief about investing? Something you believe in fervently that's not very widely believed.
Oh boy, glad we signed on for 3 hours for this podcast. So listeners, buckle in. I was actually adding to a list I have the other day, which is an old tweet that says something along the lines of, I said, you know, what of the professional investors out there, what belief do you hold that the vast majority of your peers, and meaning like 75% plus, do not share? And so it's not just that it's a non-consensus view, it has to be the vast majority of professionals don't share this view. And so I'm up to 17. So you can add that to the show note link somewhere. But tell you what, I'm going to give you two. I'm going to give you one that's focused on advisors and institutions, and the other one that's focused on individuals. And I don't really know that many people that share these views. On the individual side, back when we used to have cocktail parties, I was just in Mississippi. We were chatting about this. And so it seems like the world is reopening, which felt wonderful. But back in cocktail parties, you know, we managed 12 ETFs. And that means that invariably something is not working. You can't have that many funds that invest all over the world and something not be stinking it up. And as an investor who has been investing long enough or studied history long enough, you have to be humble. I mean, it's up there with surfing and golf as, you know, activities that just consistently humble you when you participate. And the younger crowd or even the older crowd that doesn't realize that, you know, you embrace the scars that you have from all the bad investments. There's a great old quote that says something along the lines of, you know, every trade makes you richer or wiser, but never both. And so you have the scars from investing. And so you realize that this is obviously a very humble world. Anyway, at these cocktail parties, someone would always come up to me and say, you know, Meb, I'm invested in your fund XYZ. You know, I bought it 6 months ago. It's not doing well. You know, how long do you think I should give it? I may hold it for a few more months. I like you. I'm going to give you a chance to hold it for a few more months. And I look at them and I'd smile and I say, first of all, I'd say, oh, it can get way worse than that. You know, that performance or underperformance is nothing compared to what could happen. But I used to say, I said, look, if you're investing in a fund that's not a market cap index, and even if you are, we'll get to that in a minute, I said, you probably need to give it 10 years. And they would laugh because, you know, that's a crazy amount of time. Who would give an investment 10 years? And my thinking has actually changed on this. And they would sit there quietly waiting for me to update that as a joke. And I wouldn't. And then they would awkwardly eventually be like, you can't be serious, Meb. And now I say, you know, 20, it's actually probably closer to 20 years. And let me give you an example. And so this is one of my held beliefs that if you make an investment, it doesn't matter if it's an asset class or an active strategy, the sheer amount of noise means you probably need to invest for a period of decades or more. Anything shorter than that is insufficient amount of time. And let me give you an example. there is no more single universally held belief. If you were to poll on Twitter investors a bunch of questions, this one would be number one. It'd be like 99%. It's, do you think stocks outperform bonds over time? Everyone would say yes. I don't know a single person that doesn't believe that. It's like the iron law of investing. But the reality is, then you ask people, say, well, how long would you give an investment? And we used to do Twitter polls and say, how long would you give this investment, any investment, you know, to work out if it was underperforming, how long till you sold it? And most people say 2 to 3 years. Well, let me give you an example. 2 years ago, 2020, there was a period where US stocks had had similar performance. I mean, similar being like almost exactly even as the long bond in the US for not 10 years, not 20, for 40 years. There's been periods where US stocks have gone nowhere for decades and underperformed bonds for decades. I think the longest period was something like 60 plus years. Who has that amount of time? Well, nobody. I mean, but you look at any asset and it's the same is true. You know, Vanguard's published a lot of research on active managers, and even the best ones that survive and outperform go through many years of underperformance, often sometimes many years in a row. So if you have a thesis and no one does this, write down why you're buying it. And that's what people spend 99% of the time on, but also think about why you would sell it. And everyone says, oh, I'm driven by process, not performance. But what happens? Something underperforms, it does poorly, and they sell it, which is often probably the opposite of what you should be doing. No one's ever come to me in decades of doing this and said, you know what, Meb, I bought your fund and it's done way better than I expected. I'm going to sell it, right? They don't say that. And so having this long time frame and checking your assumptions at the door, writing it down, I think is an important one. That was really long. I'm sorry, by the way, but you ask these questions and you're going to get the long answers.
No, it's a great answer. I still have never read a book with a cogent sell discipline. I don't know almost anyone who has a well-defined, logically, sort of behaviorally informed sell discipline.
Well, see, this is the beauty. So, you know, we're quant. And it doesn't have to mean like it's a high frequency trading quant. It just means rules based. And I learned this as a young 20 something where I got into many of these situations where you put on a trade and say, okay, let's just see what happens. And the problem with that, as you know, you spend a lot of your time in this world, is it then becomes an emotional decision. And so you need to have, we talked a lot about it when Peyton Manning used to be quarterback for the Broncos, said, you know, he doesn't show up the line of scrimmage, say, okay, let's just wing this. You know, he's got his audibles. He's got his setup that he knows based on the defense what's going to happen. So you should write down. And for every portfolio we run, we have every time we make a buy sell, like there are sell rules already in place for what's going to happen. It could be time based. So if you're an investor, you say, you know what, I put half in stocks, half in bonds, and rebalance once a year. That's fine, as long as you stick to it. Others may be, look, I'm going to have a tolerance band. So if I buy gold with 5% of my portfolio, I'm going to trim it when it gets to 10 or add more when it gets to 2, whatever it may be. But putting that at least framework in place gives you an anchor from which to look at when times go crazy. I mean, look at real assets right now. You know, we talk a lot about real assets on our podcast and in our papers, and most investors have almost nothing allocated to them. And we ask people, you know, how much do you have to real assets? And almost everyone is zero, with the exception of probably our pre-mentioned Canadian and Australian friends. But look what's going on in the world today with, you know, wheat up around 10 bucks, oil over 100, and copper darn near 5. So I saw gas in the wild here in LA where it was $6 and I had an $11 beer in Mississippi of all places. So the problem with that is all of a sudden everyone's going to wake up and say, oh my God, now what do I do? I don't have any of that. And so trying to have a written plan and also trying to codify the rules, I think is hugely useful because it keeps us, you know, the guardrails of doing the really dumb stuff, which is kind of, you know, the whole point of everything we're talking about, which is I don't actually think your allocation matters that much. This leads into the second one. Sorry, I'm getting long-winded, but the thing that I believe that very few, if none of my investing professional peers believe is, and we wrote a book on this called Global Asset Allocation. It's free to download online. And I believe that it's the best time ever to be an investor. 2022, you can buy a global portfolio for essentially zero fee. It's ETFs, it's like 5 basis points, gives you global stocks, bonds, real assets. With short lending, it's probably already a negative fee. Incredible, right? So that's the bar. That portfolio And it doesn't even really matter what you have of each. You could put a third in stocks, third in bonds, third in real assets. I think that portfolio beats the vast majority of institutions over time. And I'm talking CalPERS, I'm talking, you know, maybe not Yale, but probably 75% of institutions for a number of reasons. And the big one is that cost is a huge impact on investing returns. And a very simple portfolio, as long as you have the main ingredients, will probably beat most of those institutions. I had applied for the CalPERS CIO job and they declined to interview me. And probably because they may follow me on Twitter, but I said, you know what I'm going to do if I was hired for CalPERS is I would fire almost everyone. I would liquidate all the private investments and crazy hedge funds and particularly private equity. And I'd put it in a basket of ETFs. And once a year we'd get together, we'd rebalance the portfolio, have a few beers, maybe watch Seinfeld or something and just hang out. And I think we did a post on this called Should CalPERS Be Managed by a Robot? Where we demonstrated that a simple global portfolio, if you just went out and bought the world, so if you bought everything in the world, it's roughly half stocks and bonds and roughly half US and half ex-US, that basically mirrors CalPERS portfolio. So you could go through this, save all the fees, save all the effort, and brain damage and politics and just allocate it and be done with it.
You know, I'm watching some smart people on Twitter right now argue for lowering the accredited investment standards so that everyday or, you know, more everyday folks can get access to sort of sophisticated and esoteric investment vehicles. And it just doesn't matter. Like, you just don't need it. There's nothing to suggest that you have to put a lot of brain power or effort or anything into these things. If you globally diversify and you watch your Seinfeld reruns and have your beer, I really do believe you're going to outperform a lot of really smart people putting themselves through some really rigorous paces for very little effort.
Well, you know, it's funny because what do I spend 90%+ of my time talking about on Twitter usually is like pretty deep investment ideas in theory. We just wrote a piece that we tweeted out today called Red Light, which was talking about how the US stock market is expensive in a downtrend, which is like a terrible place to be. And if you didn't know me or been following us for years and read any of the books or white papers, you would be like, oh my God, Meb's calling for a crash. He's a perma bear, whatever, right? If you just came across that. But the very real reality is like, we're arguing about like the final 5%, you know, no one needs to argue about the first 90%, 95%, because what's most important, the first decision that's most important is you got to save, right? The decision to save in the first place trumps everything else. And the decision to then invest that, and again, I don't think it even matters that much what you invest in, as long as you have the main ingredients. The example we used to always give is a fellow part Southerner was my mom, you know, baking. She never read the recipe. She just kind of, you know, measured by licking her finger. And so as long as you add sugar and butter and flour, like the chocolate chip cookies ended up okay. But if you totally omitted one ingredient, it wouldn't be a great cookie. And that's the way we talk about with owning a portfolio is you just have to be an owner. And so the decision to save and invest in the first place trumps everything else. And the next decision is you invest has to be sort of the main ingredients. So globally with all these assets, and then you have to pay low fees. Our book, we looked at something like 20 different portfolios that were mimicking the best investors in the world. So Buffett, Muhammad El Arian, who used to run Harvard, you got David Swensen, Rob Arnott, on and on and on. All have stated at some point publicly, here's a recommended portfolio for individual investors. And they're hugely different. So some would say you got to put 25% in gold. Some would say zero. Some would say 90% in US stocks. Some would say 25%. And you would think they have these massive differences. And you watch CNBC all day. You listen to all the podcasts and Twitter and everything else. And you'd conclude, oh my God, it's like I spend 99% of my time focusing on like, what should I buy? Is the Fed raising rates? Is the US stock market expensive? On and on and on. And if you look at these portfolios, the example we love to give is say, I'll give Dr. Crosby a crystal ball. You can go back to the 1970s and I'll let you pick the single best performing portfolio in this book and you can have it. The rule, though, however, is you have to implement it with the average mutual fund fee of today, not from 30 or 50 years ago, but from today, which is 1.25%, still not dollar weighted, but average fee. And what that does is it takes the best performing portfolio, which was Muhammad El Arian's, a very growth heavy equity focused portfolio. And it would have taken that and made it almost as bad as the worst portfolio, which was the permanent portfolio, which, to be fair, was pretty low volatility. And it's got like half in cash and bonds. So not quite fair. But the point being is that it rendered the asset allocation decision totally irrelevant. The decision to just invest it with average fees took the best performing portfolio and made it almost as bad as the worst. You then layer in the average financial advisor, who I love listening, financial advisors, of 1%. So you're up to 2.25%. That takes the best performing portfolio and makes it far worse than the worst. And so what do people spend all the time on? They spend all the time on, you know, what do I tinkering with their allocation? But reality is you own the assets, and this is for buy and hold. You own the assets and pay as little as possible. You know, we did this. We launched it was actually the first ETF with no management fee years ago. It's a fund of funds. So it has some underlying fund costs with this theory being like, hey, look, you should just be paying as little as possible, globally diversified portfolio. And you're probably going to beat most people out there. I would say that idea has been moving in the right direction over the past few decades, particularly with Vanguard's help and others. The rest of the world is decades behind. You still have ridiculously high fees in a lot of places. The US is moving in the right direction, but still, you still have a ton of, it's almost a trillion in asset allocation mutual funds that are just stranded because people have forgotten about them or died, or they're just sitting there and they have gains that charge way more than a free portfolio would today. So while I love debating the final 5%, and I think it's important for a lot of reasons, and we can spend all the rest of the podcast talking about it, I think, you know, some of the big muscle movements are to save and invest, pay low fees, put it on autopilot, and move on.
Yeah. People have a hard time believing that it's really that simple, but it actually is. So I said at the outset that your work had really influenced the way that I think about investing, and that's the truth. And my introduction to your work was a paper called A Quantitative Approach to Tactical Asset Allocation that is one of the more downloaded of all time on SSRN. Is it number one? Am I giving you sufficient credit here?
It used to be number one. It might be number two now. I got to update it. We got to reclaim the title. I can't let that stand. My favorite was, though, it used to be in the top five with the efficient market hypothesis, or one of those papers by, and I love Fama and those guys. I think they're an American treasure. But I just thought it was funny because they were, could not be more juxtaposed than right. the two of those.
It's like the year they gave out the behavioral finance Nobel Prize, along with the efficient market Nobel Prize.
Yeah. Right.
So this is a fantastic work, A Quantitative Approach to Tactical Asset Allocation. I'd recommend it to everyone because market timing gets a bad reputation in our industry, and much of that's justifiable. But what you've done in your latest piece, Red Light, is something that I did upon reading your seminal paper, which is I overlaid valuations on top of it and found that there was information in combining valuation levels with technical support levels. So can you talk about your sort of red light, green light approach and how you think about market timing and tactical asset allocation?
Yeah, you know, I start from the premise that everything is market timing. You know, you decide to buy a car or a house, you decide to send your kid to college, you get a bonus, what do you do with it? Whether you're dollar cost averaging, whatever, you're making decisions with that money every day. And buy and hold is a totally fine way to go about it. However, there's a big flaw in buy and hold that we don't talk enough about as an industry, which is thinking about human capital and the emotional side of investing. The big problem with buy and hold is you're owning risk assets. Great, right? You want to own risk assets. The problem with risk assets is they are highly correlated with the economy. And so think back last 20 years when things are hitting the fan, global financial crisis, pandemic, possibly World War III. You know, there's no better person to spend this with, by the way, than you on the eve of everything crazy going on. But if you think about it, what happens during those periods? Recessions, the economy tanks. And guess what? Just to put the cherry on top, your portfolio goes down 20, 50%, right? Like that's kind of backwards the way it should be. And the challenge with buy and hold, you know, Buffett talks a lot about this. He's like, look, if you, or Munger, can't remember which of the two, says basically, if you can't handle 50% drawdowns, you shouldn't be investing in quoted stocks. That's reality. And there's no stock market in the world that hasn't had a two-thirds decline at some point. U.S. decline over 80 in the Depression. So we've been there. And the challenge with that is it all happens at the same time. And theoretically, you would want something probably that does the inverse of that. When you get fired and the economy is in recession and the zombie apocalypse is happening with the pandemic, all those things are happening, you'd actually probably want something to be doing better. And particularly the financial advisors out there, we wrote a paper on this on tail risk where we said, look, you're probably four times leveraged the stock market. You don't know it. You have your own money in the stock market. You have your clients' money in the stock market. You get your fees based on clients and stock market. When the stock market goes down, your clients redeem because they're crazy. And then lastly, if you don't work for your own company, that company may downsize because their revenue went down and may fire you too. So it's like you can make an argument that the average financial advisor shouldn't own any U.S. stocks. Anyway, so as you think about all this, and when you think about markets in general, I'm a big student of history. So you look back 100 years and two of the biggest pillars that Cambria builds our portfolios on are value on one side. So Ben Graham talking about this 100 years ago, and then trend. And Charles Dow and others were talking about this 100 years ago. And value is easy. Everyone knows what that means. Follow Warren Buffett, trying to buy something less than its intrinsic value. Think it works great. Our largest fund is a value fund. But on the flip side, and it's sort of a yin-yang in many ways, is trend. And what do we mean when we say trend? So the simplest example is you want to be owning an asset when it goes up and out of it, or selling it when it goes down. You know, sounds simple, lofty goal. But going back 100 years, you can look at something like a very basic, and this isn't mine, but the most talked about probably is the 200-day moving average. And it's meant to just smooth things out, all the day-to-day wiggles, and try to pick something where over a long enough period, you can get the signal from the noise. And very simply is you could look at it, and we use the 10-month simple moving average in our paper because it was on a monthly time horizon. And you go back 100 years, you don't really have daily data that's that useful. And so we said, okay, what if we just invested when above and out when below? And lo and behold, it worked out great. It didn't work out the way that everyone wants it to work, which is I want to be able to pick tops and bottoms so I can tell my neighbors how smart I am. But what it does is it keeps you invested for the majority of a move, but more importantly, it keeps you out of a majority of a big move down. And I don't mean 5, 10% moves. I mean the 40, 60, 80, 100% moves down. And the beauty of that, historically speaking, is it reduces your volatility. You get to hang out in cash or bonds or whatever you want to put it in when things are looking nasty. And by the way, we updated this at the end of the month, which was the end of February. And every single asset of the main ones, U.S. stocks, foreign stocks, bonds, real estate, commodities, they were all down with the exception of commodities, which are still in an uptrend. And historically speaking, that portfolio gives you similar returns. I actually think it'll be higher, but we'll call it a wash, but with a lot lower volatility and drawdown. Importantly, though, it usually does a great job when the markets are stressed and doing poorly. So think internet bubble, financial crisis, pandemic. We'll see what happens in 2022. But it says it's time to step aside. And the volatility is much higher in downtrends than in uptrends. And that's partially, in your world where people start to lose their mind and use a different part of their brain when they're losing money than making money. Making money, what are we talking about? We're talking about Dogecoin, taking vacation, buying a house, how smart I am. You're losing money. It's shame. You don't want to open your statements. You don't want to pick up Robinhood app. You don't want to tell your friends about how smart you were to buy Tesla at 1,000, on and on, right? So the problem with this portfolio, there's nothing that's like the holy grail of investing. And the original title of this paper, by the way, was A Simple Approach to Market Timing. And we sent it to a handful of luminaries. I'm in my 20s at that point, by the way. I'm now middle-aged, 44. And sent around to a lot of people and got some pretty nasty responses, including some future Nobel laureates. And, you know, they said, you know, market timing doesn't work. I changed the title so it sounded a little more academic.
A little more respectable, yeah.
Right. And this came out before the financial crisis. And so nice timing on that. But the problem with this portfolio is not during the bad times, because usually it's chilling out in cash and does totally fine. The problem is in the good periods, because everything else is romping, right? When U.S. stocks are going up 20% a year, you know, this market timing approach probably isn't going to look as great. And you have a lower batting average. So trend following in general, you know, you may have some whipsaws. So we wrote recently, if you put the U.S. stock market into four quadrants, and this now includes value, the best performing quadrant is a cheap investment in an uptrend. So when the U.S. stock market's cheap in an uptrend, it does like 17% a year. Amazing, right? And that's my favorite investment, is when value and trend intersect. But the second best performing quadrant is an expensive uptrend. And that's a little counterintuitive for most, but as a bubble is inflating or as markets getting more expensive, as long as it's an uptrend, it does just fine. The problem is when it flips from expensive uptrend to an expensive downtrend, which is where we are today, the results get far worse. So anyway, it's a rules-based approach. It gives you that quantitative in and out signals. Now, the problem is it's no easier than buy and hold. I'd argue it's actually probably harder, because for many people, they want to be right. There's an old Ned Davis book called Being Right or Making Money. And most people, their goal is they really want to be right. They don't like the feeling of being wrong. But we often say, to be a good investor, you have to be good at losing, because all assets, doesn't matter which one, spend about 80% of time in some form of drawdown. You know, it's pretty rare for them to be hitting all-time highs. So what we end up doing at Cambria, and what I do personally, designed this for myself, and it's our flagship strategy. It's called Trinity. But basically put half in buy and hold and half in this sort of global momentum and trend strategy. And we go a step further, where that side of the portfolio concentrates in the highest momentum assets, meaning what's been going up the most relative to other assets, but only if it's in an uptrend. And so that strategy right now, not surprisingly, is very heavy in commodities and real assets, base metals, ags, energy, real estate, which is a great place to be right now, of course, but it gives you that sort of yin-yang exposure. And if you look at 2020, is a great example. First quarter of 2020, it looked like the zombie apocalypse. I mean, it looked like the world was going to end, right? Everyone was just keeling over in the streets. We had this terrible virus. And I was like, man, thank God for market timing. It looks like the stock market go down 80%. The world's going to end. And then fast forward to the next quarter, I said, man, thank God for buy and hold, because everything just ripped right back up. The beauty of this is actually a sort of emotional, psychological hack to where you never have all in on one side or the other. That's really, I mean, a lot of people in our world like to gamble. They may not say they do, but they like to speculate and gamble with their investments so that they can have something to cheer for. And they actually really don't like being diversified or being kind of halvesies in an investment, is what we call it. But if you really care about, you know, getting to the finish line and having an investing approach that will keep you behaving and sane, I like to sleep. Huge sleeper. You know, to me, this is a thoughtful way to go about it. It checks all the boxes I can possibly think of.
Well, it's got some return upside, as you outlined nicely in your pieces, Red Light and the original paper, but it's also got profound behavioral upside and sleep well at night upside, as you've just mentioned. You know, I think about value and momentum almost as, or trend as almost like potential energy, right? Like if you think about a ramp, the steepness of the ramp, you know, equate that to the valuation, gives you more potential energy. So if you put a marble at the top of the ramp and it's very steep, it's going to roll pretty fast. But if it's fairly valued, if it's, you know, relatively flat, it may not do all that much. And indeed, that's what my looking into these ideas has shown as well. So,
there's one more part that I think is important. It goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning, full circle. You know, when people talk about the buy and sell decisions, how many people do you know that after the financial crisis, or I'm sure pandemic is more recent, said, I can't take anymore, sold everything, right? And probably in 2008, 2009, or 2020. But then they had no framework for how to get back in.
Right.
And so I talked to investors for that entire decade. It would be 2010, 2011, 2012, on 2015, 2017. They say, you know what, Meb, been following you for years. Love your work. Here's my situation. You know, da-da-da, da-da-da, da-da-da. I sold everything. and I haven't got back in yet. And to me, that's tragic because you want to be invested the vast majority of the time. You know, you want to have exposure to risk assets. That's this whole point of being an owner. You have to be an owner. And it's heartbreaking to hear that because you end up missing so much of this time in the market. And the beauty of the trend side is says, look, it's got a sell discipline, tells you when to get out, but also tells you when to get back in. And that to me is super important. Now, the trade signal may only last a month. It could last 5 years. Who knows? But to me, it gives you an objective framework from at least to begin to think about the world and think about surviving this, you know, this asset allocation sort of decision.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyone who's listened this far in the episode knows that there's plenty of great reasons to follow you online. But one of my favorites is that from time to time, you give out free business ideas. These are really good business ideas that you just don't have the bandwidth to run with. Has anyone ever run with one of these ideas? And what's your latest and greatest business idea that you're happy to share with the people?
Well, the full qualifier that I like to say is these are Meb's wonderful, parentheses, terrible business ideas. But, you know, we've posted a lot over the years, and actually most of them have been implemented to some degree. Now, sometimes it's not a company. You know, a lot of ideas doesn't have to be a company. It could just be a feature as a part of another company. Sure. And many of them have been implemented over the years, which is pretty awesome to see. And it's a lot of these, I'm just like, well, someone please do this. My God, I don't want to do it. It's too much work. Being an entrepreneur is the worst job on the planet, listeners. And those who are business owners, or have been through it can resonate with that sentiment. It's a lot of work. Let me think. So, you know, having experienced the whole Robinhood meme stock experience from a very front row seat, you know, it's heartbreaking in so many levels. You know, you and I both talk, I think, a lot about educating investors and wanting people to learn the right lessons and the importance of teaching personal finance in school and the importance of people getting invested and doing the right things. You know, Wall Street can be incredibly manipulative, and they're going to take advantage of you left, right, center whenever they get the chance to. And so having an educated populace but I want 100% of people in our country to be investors, you know, and we wrote a blog post called How to Narrow the Wealth and Income Gap that I think touches on a lot of these topics. But I have a huge and very public sort of brawl with Robinhood and that type of mentality, because to me it's leading all there's one incredible thing they've done, which is onboard millions of people into the investing world that weren't there before. So God bless you, but they've led them to the casino and taught them all the wrong lessons, and it's heartbreaking to see. The challenge, I think, is coming up with incentives. Like Munger says, you know, incentives, show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. Coming up with systems that help people, you know, Richard Thaler, the Nobel Prize economist, we had him on the show. He talks about his nudges, right? Like pushing people, just guiding them in the right decision. You can still make your own decision, but I'm going to kind of push you along. And so, you know, to me, Robinhood is the opposite of that. And every possible scenario, they take the wrong way at the fork. And whether it's through scratch off lottery, whether it's through confetti, whether it's through doing all these things they shouldn't be doing, whether it's straight up lying, which they've done many times, it's really hard to see. So, you know, we used to always tell, I mean, I'm like, Vanguard to me is like the gold standard starting point. Like, you know, we used to tell people, if you onboarded Robinhood, go check out Vanguard. But I like to think of an idea, and here's one I haven't done, but I would love it if someone else does it. And it's called the Forever Fund. You know, so we manage 12 ETFs. What's the problem with that? As we've seen in the long history of investing, investors love to chase returns. Our bud Mark Yusko calls it, they buy what they wish they had bought. And so you have a hot manager right now. Well, not right now. Last year, it was ARK. Years before, it was CGM, Ken Huebner. Years before, it was Bruce Berkowitz at Fairholm. On and on, right? In the 90s, it was Janus. And the problem is people buy those funds after they have a big run. So you get a 50% up year, 100% up year, on and on. People then get into those funds. And then what happens? The asset class or the strategy turns. You're seeing that over the past year. value and growth, and then it implodes, and then everyone sells. And often these managers, and it's often no fault of the managers, sometimes they encourage it, but they'll have great track record. They may do 15% a year, but in the case of CGM and now ARK, the average investor has lost money in those funds, which is crazy, right? Absolutely insane. And so my idea is that start a fund. We're going to call it the Forever Fund. And it's not going to have a lockup, but you invest low cost portfolio of global assets. And if you sell it in the first year, you get hit with a 10% penalty. Year two, 9, all the way up to 10 years. So you only invest in this if you want to. Everyone says they have a long-term horizon. They never do. But so it's like, put your money where your mouth is. You're going to invest for 10, 20, 30 years and compound. Let's see it. So you put your, so that's sort of the, what's dissuading you from selling, keeping you behaving. But on the flip side is the manager doesn't keep the reward. So you take all the people that sold too early and paid the fee, and then you rebate it or dividend to all the other investors in the fund. So you get sort of an idiot slash good behavior reward where people get penalized for selling. And by the way, a lot of companies have these back-end sales loads. They just keep them. Vanguard has like a 90-day clause that keeps a lot of their mutual funds from people trying to actively trade them. I just want to extend it to 10 years. Now, the problem with this, of course, is I'll probably get sued. Once we get to a certain size, we manage almost $1.5 billion now. We get to a certain size, I'm going to say, I don't care. I'm going to do it anyway. Sue me all you want. But trying to come up with these structures, you could do it as a brokerage app too. You could do the anti-Robin Hood and say, hey, look, you know, you put on this position. We're going to charge you nothing. We'll give you the short lending revenue, the payment for overflow. We'll do all the good things in your best interest. But you sell this, it doesn't have to be 10 years. It could be 5 or something. We're going to charge you a fee or commission. And, you know, whether we keep it or whether we distribute it, I would love to see that model. Would anyone actually invest in it? I don't know. But I think it's a fun one.
A true behavioral Robin Hood, robbing from the poorly behaved to give to the well-behaved. I love it. I love it. So, Ned, we got like 2 more minutes before I have to run, but I want to know, you are one of the most prolific angel investors I know, and that sort of angel investing doesn't always lend itself to the kind of quantitative rigor that characterizes your public equity investing. I'm curious what lessons you've learned throughout your time as an angel investor and how you would analogize your public versus private market investing.
I think for a long time, people looked at private investments and said they're illiquid, and that's a problem. I actually think it's probably a feature at this point, given what we just talked about is, you know, we talk a lot about farmland. I come from a partial farm background in Kansas, Nebraska, and, you know, you go look at farmland, you can't sell it. I mean, you can, but it's illiquid like a house, which is a good thing because I think people mentally bucket those types of investments differently than they do their brokerage account. And I think target date funds probably end up in the same category, which is great. So when you think about investing and you go back to Buffett first principles, what do you want? You want a killer company that has product market fit, that's changing the world, you can get excited about, that also is generating revenue and cash flow and profits, and an amazing CEO on a mission that you can believe in and get excited about. I mean, like SpaceX, something like that, right? Which I actually passed on, not at the angel stage, but later, and of course, regret it. But so almost a decade ago, I started angel investing. And we talk a lot about this for listeners who want to get deep in it. We have a blog post called Journey that goes deep on this topic. But in reality was, look, I want to get smart on this investing approach. I want to start to review a lot of early stage investments. And so we're talking about market cap of like 5, 10, 15 million versus, you know, a small cap in US stocks is like 300 million. So it's already 10, 20X the size of a small cap. And most mid and large caps get into the billion, 10 billion. Now Apple's a $2 trillion company, hard to even say anymore. Anyway, said, look, I want to get educated on this. If I break even, great. If I match the S&P, even better. If I make money on top of that, hallelujah. And started to invest. And there's a long discussion about ways to do this. I think that's very thoughtful, a long-term time horizon. But the reality of what angel and startup VC investors understand that's also true in public investments is this concept of power laws. Meaning if you make 100 investments in startups, only a handful, less than five probably, are going to determine all of your return. You invest in an early stage Uber and it goes 100x, 1000x. That's going to drive all your return. That's actually true in public markets too. A lot of people don't appreciate that. It's roughly 5 to 10% of US stocks deliver all of the return. McDonald's, Walmart's, Apple, Amazon, et cetera. And so by owning an index, you're guaranteed to own the winners, which is why you have that 8-10% return over time. But on startups, you're starting from a much smaller base. You can make a life-changing amount of money. It has similar challenges as trend following. You're wrong often. So the vast, I've made over 300 startup investments over the years. And many of them, probably over 100, will be worth either nothing or return roughly the same amount. But many others will return 20, 50, 100, or even hopefully 1,000 times your money. I mean, that's crazy. Think about that number. Yeah. 100 times. You put in even a modest amount of money, $5,000, 100x is a life-changing amount of money for most people. That's a house, right? That's paying for, you know, an entire brood of children's college education. But here's the hack, is that you invest in a startup company, you can't sell it, right? Your outcomes are either goes to zero, goes bankrupt, it gets acquired, or it goes public. That's about it, right? And so the beauty of this approach is you are stuck in, and that's the whole point of investing to me, is you want these companies. And so if you do it thoughtfully and over time, I think you end up with a beautiful portfolio of companies. And we do a whole startup series on the blog, talking to founders from all over the world, all over the globe, Africa, Pakistan. And I think it's the biggest last comment is the public markets are a consistent stream of negative news flow. I mean, the Fed, gold, wars, pandemics, whereas startups, and I've reviewed over 5,000 decks at this point, startups, it's optimistic every day. They're changing the world. They're developing new biotech therapies. They're, you know, space is being a big theme for us, mental health, all, on and on, emerging markets. But you see these incredible, motivated people trying to change the world. And so it's like the total barbell of the depressing negative emotions of public markets. So if anyone wants to get started, you can reach out or check out that blog post that'll give you more more info.
So Meb, thank you for your time and your insight today. Everyone, Meb's show, the Meb Faber Show podcast, actually has a wonderful series going right now about entrepreneurship in Africa. Meb is always covering, I think, topics that are controversial. He approaches markets from new angles and just looks at the world in a refreshing and unexpected way. So thank you for the work you do. If people want to learn more about you and your company, where can they find you?
My brother, it's been a blast. Thanks for having me. Can't wait to do this in person again soon. We're a little bit everywhere. Not too many Mebs run around the world. So we got Meb Faber is the blog and Twitter. Cambria Funds and Cambria Investments are my day job. And shoot me an email anytime. Love to say hi to people or join you for a bite or a brew in the real world.
All right. Thanks again, Meb.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.